Okay, before I begin, does anyone have any questions or any comments that you want to make? I did have one little announcement. You may have seen these signs around campus. Tomorrow at noon, Professor David Andrews from Claremont is coming here to give a talk on the euro and the future of Europe. And if any of you are interested in the current euro crisis over in Europe, you may be interested in coming here and talk. And also, by the way, they generally give out a free lunch there. So they haven't announced it because that might attract too many people. But today I'm going to be talking about the coming of the Cold War in 1946-1947. Why is this a puzzle? You know, the whole thrust of the argument in the lecture last time is that the Cold War is profoundly puzzling. Why is it puzzling? Because at the end of World War II, you have the situation where Europe is divided between East and West. Maybe the United States would have loved to see democratic regimes spread throughout Europe. Maybe the Soviets would have loved to see communist regimes, you know, in all of Europe, you know, straight through to the Atlantic. But those ideological preferences had to be disciplined by a sense for power realities. Power political considerations were bound to come into play. Yes, we might have liked to see democratic regimes in Eastern Europe, but not if it meant the Third World War. You know, we can live with the status quo. You might not like it, it might not be ideal, but the status quo of a divided Europe is okay because our fundamental interests are preserved. What's our fundamental interest? In preventing the vast resources of Europe, of Eurasia, from coming under the control of a single hostile power, whether it was the Nazis or the Soviets. We had a power political interest in preventing that from happening. Well, you achieved that goal because by the end of the war, the most developed, most industrialized, most technologically advanced parts of Europe are under the control of the Western powers, of the United States and her friends, especially Britain, to a certain extent also France. We can live with that. Not ideal, but certainly better than the alternative of war. Stalin, also very much too inclined to think in spheres of influence terms, power political terms, great respect, and this is rooted in the Marxist philosophy, great respect for American industrial power and therefore for America's war-making capabilities. He is not going to want a new world war, especially after what the Soviets had just come through at the hands of the Germans. So he has an interest in reaching some sort of accommodation with the Americans on the basis of mutual respect for the status quo, the status quo of a divided Europe, and therefore the status quo of a divided Germany. Continent of Europe is divided. Soviet forces occupy the area east of the line of demarcation in Europe. American, British, French forces occupy the area west of the line of demarcation in Europe in general, and in Germany in particular. And you can live with this. This is, you know, that's the basic thrust of the Stalin philosophy. It's not like he wanted a conflict with the West. He wanted an accommodation with the West. He wanted the West to respect Soviet interests in Eastern Europe. He wanted the West to accept the fact that Eastern Europe was a Soviet sphere of influence. And the extraordinary thing when you analyze the 1945 story is that the American government moves in that direction toward a spheres of influence policy. Right? Not at Yalta. There's a big myth in Europe that Yalta meant the division of Europe between Eastern and Western spheres of influence. That wasn't quite the case. Roosevelt was willing to accept the fact that the communists would play a leading role, not the leading role, in Poland after the war. But ultimately, the fate of Poland would be decided by free elections. That was part of the Yalta Agreement. And Roosevelt was upset when it turned out that in the last month of his life, that the Soviets weren't living up to the terms of that agreement. But under Truman, instead of a headlong rush to the Cold War, you have a shift in U.S. policy toward accommodation, toward the acceptance of the notion of spheres of influence. And this is most striking when you analyze the evidence on the Potsdam Conference. I must say, when I did this work, it took me a long time to sort it out. I was just flabbergasted. I was just absolutely stunned. The Potsdam, everyone had said, they pointed to the formal agreement that had been reached at Potsdam, the Potsdam Protocol. This called for running Germany as a unit, all this kind of unitary language in the formal agreement. But when you look at the actual records, what was actually said, at the sort of thinking that you see expressed at Potsdam, especially by Secretary of State Burns, who's a real maker of American policy in this period, not Truman, right? Burns was very clearly thinking in terms of, we'll run things in the West, you'll run things in the East, and on that basis we can get along. Strategy of the amicable divorce. We're not close enough with you politically to have true political intimacy and run Germany on a unitary basis. We can't have the same relationship with you. Basically, this is the message that's given Stalin that we have with the British, but we can get along by pulling apart. This was not clear at the time. It was not clear to the public at the time. It was not even clear within the government at the time that this was what Burns was up to. But what I'll tell you the story of what happened. As the Cold War set in, the notion grew up that the Democrats, who had been in charge of policy during the war and in the immediate post-war period, were naive, they were soft, that they allowed Stalin to kind of pull them by the nose and so on. And so there was this kind of Republican campaign against Roosevelt, Roosevelt and the Yalta thing. They had sold Poland down the river, and Yalta was this kind of terrible thing based on these naive assumptions about the Soviets and so on. So the Republicans, when they basically take control of the government in 1953, the Republicans in the Congress, they pass a law mandating that the State Department publish the records of the Yalta Conference, because it's a big myth about Yalta. And Secretary of State, the Republican Secretary of State at that time, John Foster Dulles, he knew better than to believe these kind of right-wing Republican myths, but he felt like there was an advantage in getting the information out. So they went along with the whole idea of publishing the documents. So it's to kind of deflate that myth, right? And as long as they were publishing the documents about Yalta, kind of as an afterthought, they said, and also the records of the other wartime conferences, Tehran and Potsdam. And so in 1960, the State Department published this extraordinary two-volume collection, like thousands of pages of documents relating to the Potsdam Conference. And so for the first time, it was possible to see, what Burns was up to, the meaning of the Burns Plan for Reparations, the whole zonal thrust of American policy, the fact that all the unitary language is just a facade, right? But by that time, all these myths about the early Cold War had taken hold, and people were essentially incapable, this is true both on the left and on the right, of seeing the evidence for what it was. And it's true, it took quite an effort to kind of, dig into all this material and sort it out. But people were just unwilling to see it. And my favorite example of this is a famous left-wing historian named William Appleman Williams, who wrote a famous book, came out in the late 1950s, called The Tragedy of American Diplomacy. And the problem was that the Americans were just so committed to the open door so that America could export to wherever she wanted. This was a necessity of the American capitalist system. And for this reason, they wouldn't accept, you know, a kind of closed door in Eastern Europe. And this is one of the things that basically triggered the Cold War. He had that view. So the Potsdam documents come out in 1960, and Williams reads the stuff, and he says, gee, I see Secretary Burns, you know, saying all of these other things about, you know, the Soviets would have a free hand in their part of Germany and implicitly in their part of Europe. And this kind of contradicts this. Then he says, but I can't really take that seriously, because when he came back from Potsdam, Burns gave a speech to the country that had all this kind of Wilsonian rhetoric in it. So you're going to accept a speech that was given in public as a more accurate indicator of people's true thinking than what you actually find in the secret documents? You know, every instinct of a historian should go in the opposite direction. But that's a measure of how impervious people can be to the appearance of new evidence if that new evidence contradicts their fundamental convictions. And so the real story of Potsdam was just like totally ignored. It wasn't just Potsdam and the implications of the Burns plan for dealing with the reparations, and therefore dealing with German foreign trade, dealing with the German economy as a whole, where the U.S. conception was very clearly a zonal conception, a conception that looked toward the division of Germany between East and West, right? It wasn't just that, but after Potsdam, in the latter half of 1945, you see the Americans increasingly moving in the direction of spheres of influence, you know, between East and West. We accept Eastern Europe as a Soviet sphere of influence. In exchange for that, they accept Western Europe as a Western sphere of influence. Stalin keeps the communist parties, you know, in places like France and Italy, where they were very big in that period, on a short leash. He accepts American predominance in Japan. You know, this is the meaning of the Moscow Agreement of December of 1947. And what was so extraordinary about that story is you have these two highly ideological countries, the United States and the Soviet Union. But in each case, the ideology is kept under control. These countries are forced to pull in their horns because geopolitical realities are so salient. They're just unavoidable. You can't contemplate a purely ideological policy, because that would mean war. You want to stabilize things on the basis of the status quo. We can live together. We might not like it might not be our ideal thing, but we can live with this stuff because it's much better than a war, right? So you think that's the direction things are moving in. What we're doing is we're bringing the insights of international relations theory to bear. These notions that countries have to pay attention to power realities, that they're front and center in their thinking about these things, right? And so when you look at these U.S.-Soviet relations in the post-war period from that perspective, from you know, bringing those theoretical notions to bear, you say, where's the problem? Why is there a problem? You know, both sides prefer the status quo to a war. Both sides, therefore, are willing to live with the status quo. We're not going to go to war to kick them out of Eastern Europe. They're not going to go to war to kick us out of Western Europe. Both sides realize this. They're, in fact, moving in that direction toward a kind of a more or less open acceptance of that fundamental reality. So how do you explain the Cold War? See, the theory would have been wonderful for explaining the absence of the Cold War. And what the theory does is it underscores the fact that the Cold War is profoundly puzzling. If both sides are willing to live with the status quo, where does the Cold War come from? Because it's very clear that by early 1946, you know, just a couple months after this Moscow meeting, the two sides are like on a collision course. They're screaming at each other, right, about blaming each other for the sorts of situation that developed. And one of the most famous things here is the Churchill Iron Curtain speech. This is in March of 1946. I'll just play this to you.
It is my duty to state before you, gentlemen, about the present situation in Europe. And I would like to state the issue in the Baltic to clear in the Adriatic. Iron Curtain has descended across the Iron Curtain by all the capitals of the ancient states of Central and Eastern Europe. Warsaw, Berlin, Prague, Vienna, Budapest, Belgrade, Bucharest, and Tokyo. All these famous cities and the populations around them lie in what I must call the Soviet. And all our country, in one form or another, not only to Soviet influence, but to a very high and in some cases increasing degree of control from Moscow.
Very, very famous speech. And this was like one of the opening shots in the Cold War. Look at what these people are doing. How outrageous. They've imposed their communist system, their Soviet control on all of Europe, lying to the east of the line of Asia. And it wasn't just Churchill. Churchill's not in power, by the way. He's not prime minister anymore, so he can speak very freely. You may have noticed that Truman sitting over here right behind him, President Truman. The U.S. government, in the spring of 1946, also starts talking along these lines. And it's how outrageous Soviet behavior is, you know. And what they do is they point to Potsdam, to the formal Potsdam Agreement, which is, you know, that's what people knew about Potsdam, all this language about running Germany as a unit. They're unwilling to run Germany as a unit. They're reneging on their commitments that they undertook at Potsdam. This is the official U.S. line in 1946. How outrageous this is. What nerve they have doing this. You know, they had promised that they would work with us in running Germany on a unitary basis. And now what they're doing is they're organizing their own little communist police state in the eastern part of Germany, the part that they control. How outrageous. And Soviets, of course, respond in kind. So there's this war of words in 1946. You look at this and you say, what happened? What happened to the Potsdam Understanding, to the Burns Policy of 1945, to the Moscow Agreement of December 1945, to the fact that it seemed that both sides were moving toward the idea that, you know, we can live with things, we can coexist on the basis of each side controls its part of Europe. What happened? That's the fundamental puzzle. It's not about Eastern Europe. Eastern Europe, the Americans, in effect, had already accepted as a Soviet sphere of influence. It must be about something else. What intervened, right? So the function of the theory is to get you to see that there is a puzzle here. Theory doesn't answer that puzzle. It brings it into focus because it suggests that there's something very odd about the Cold War. If you didn't take that theoretical perspective and you just looked at these things using the notions that you absorb from the general culture about, oh, there are these ideological differences, tension is very natural, and so on, you wouldn't see how puzzling these events are. But the theory serves to bring the puzzle into focus. And so how do we answer the puzzle? We know that the key thing here is that there's a shift in U.S. policy. It's the Americans at Potsdam and Moscow especially, latter half of 1945, who had been actually taking the lead in pressing for a spheres of influence understanding. And now it's the Americans who are objecting to this. Right? The Americans have taken the lead in pushing for this arrangement, symbolized by the Burns Plan at Potsdam, for each side having a free hand in its part of Germany. Now the Americans are expressing outrage about the fact that the Soviets aren't willing to run Germany on a unitary basis. The Americans had originally taken the lead in pressing for a zonal arrangement, and now they're saying when the Soviets are pursuing that sort of policy, this is a total outrage. How is that American policy to be explained? That's the puzzle. And if you want the answer, you have to look at what was going on in international politics in early 1946. Not in Europe, but rather in another part of the world. The part that lies just to the south of Russia. Turkey and Iran. This is what triggers these things. This is what makes the policy of the amicable divorce, of the more or less friendly division of Europe into spheres of influence. This is what undercuts the viability of that policy. What happened? What happened with this, with the southern border of the Soviet Union, with Turkey and Iran? Well, Stalin. This was a wonderful story that the Soviet Foreign Minister Molotov later told in his memoirs about a meeting he had with Stalin in. About this time, and Stalin had a map of the USSR pinned to the wall, and he was meeting with Molotov, and he says to Molotov, you know, basically, I'm very happy with what we've accomplished in Europe, in the Far East, but the one area where I'm not happy with our borders, that's the South, and he points his finger at Turkey and Iran. Stalin thinks of himself as the heir of the Tsars, you know, as the embodiment of Russian imperial interests. The Tsarist regime before 1914 had had clear aspirations for gaining control over the Turkish Straits, the keys to our house, one of the Tsars called them, and also over at least northern Iran. And Stalin's feeling, and he's quite open about this when he's meeting with Churchill and Truman at Potsdam, is that the Soviets have a right, as a great power, to control of the Turkish Straits. The Americans control the Panama Canal, the British control the Suez Canal, and Russia should have control over a waterway of equivalent strategic importance to them, namely the Turkish Straits. And in fact, in the year 1945, the Russians started to kind of put pressure on the Turks to allow the Russians to kind of get control over that area, to base troops in that area. The Turks resist. You may say, why on earth would Stalin do this if he was interested in accommodation with the West? The answer is the Americans have by no means made it clear that they viewed this this demand on the part of the Soviets is unacceptable, and that they would throw their power into the balance in order to prevent the Soviets from achieving those goals. And in fact, when this crisis started heating up in late 1945, Truman's initial reaction is, well, we can't do anything. And from the Soviet standpoint, if the Americans aren't going to be resisting in there, why not push ahead? You know, if for some reason the Americans changed their mind and made a big deal out of this business, Soviets could always pull back. So you have Soviet pressure on Turkey increasing, and the American attitude evolving to the point where, we shouldn't allow the Soviets to kind of get away with this. It's like, you have to draw the line somewhere. The hope had been that we would draw the line at the areas that the Soviets had gotten control over at the end of World War II, but they couldn't just be allowed to take one country after another. and Turkey, had the right to control its own destiny and so on. So American policy, in fact, hardens. Like December 45, January 1946, and move toward the notion that if we had to, we'll go to war for the sake of Turkey. By the way, these attitudes, the Soviets found out about. How did they find out about? Because there was a spy that they had who was very well placed. His name was Donald McLean, and he was connected with the British embassy in Washington at that time. And he was privy to what the Americans were thinking, and he would report on this to Moscow. And in fact, as the Americans make it clear that they are going to really take a strong stand over this Turkish business, Soviets end up in 1946 pulling back. Similarly, there's another crisis that unfolds at pretty much the same time over Iran. Iran had been neutral in the war, but that had prevented the Allies from moving into Iran and taking over, occupying Iranian territory, because Iran was very important as a pipeline for America to supply the Soviet Union with lend-lease goods. And the arrangement was that the occupation of Iran by the Allies was supposed to end within 6 months after the end of the war. So the Soviets weren't living up to their part of this agreement. And it was clear the Soviet forces would not be out by that deadline. And in fact, the Red Army was supporting separatist regimes in the Iranian north, especially Azerbaijan, Iranian Azerbaijan. And once again, you find a hardening of the American policy. We make a big deal over this, especially in March, bringing this business to the attention of the United Nations. And the UN in those days was a big deal. The infant United Nations was a major part of American policy, at least at the declaratory level. And all this talk about use of force, et cetera, et cetera. And once again, 1946, the Soviets pulled back. In early 1946, they pulled back from Iran, and in fact, they withdrew their troops from Iran. Crises have run their course. You may say, well, what's the effect of the crisis? It simply makes it clear where the line of demarcation runs. Just as the, whatever tensions there had been over Eastern Europe had run their course by the end of 1947, and it was clear that Eastern Europe would be in the Soviet sphere of influence, now these crises of early 1946 made it clear that Turkey and Iran would lie outside the Soviet sphere of influence. Okay? So where's the problem? The problem was, the effect was, that these events in the Near East, in Turkey and Iran, led to a transformation of American policy. American policy in 1945 was based on the notion, yeah, the peace would be based on spheres of influence, but in a relatively friendly way. You wouldn't need military power to be too overt. It could be kept in the deep background. Each side would accept the other side's particular position in Europe, and on that basis we could live together. And now the Americans had come to the conclusion that that sort of understanding, it just was not an adequate basis for the international order because absent the threat of force, absent military power, there would be no way of restraining the Soviets. Right? They needed to be confronted with hard military power in order to get them to accept the limits on their sphere. And you see this in all kinds of little ways. One little indicator has to do with a little story Truman liked to tell about joke that Stalin made it at Potsdam. You may have heard about this. For some reason, they were discussing the Vatican, and Stalin kind of turns to Truman and he kind of whispers to him talking about the Pope. He says, "Well, how many divisions does he have?" You know, it's like, why should we worry about this when this guy has no military power whatsoever? And Truman at Potsdam was very amused by this, and this is part of the reason he had kind of warmed up to Stalin. Stalin had this kind of cynical sense of humor like that appealed to Truman. But by early 1946, Truman is telling the same story about how many divisions does the Pope have as evidence of how awful Stalin is and how the only thing he cares about is brute force and so on. So you find the American attitude changing, and it's like, we have to mobilize power. We have to throw power into the balance. We have to confront the other side with military strength. And what that means for a country like the United States is that you have to mobilize the feelings of your own people. There's this terrible fear in the American elite after World War II that what happened after World War I is going to repeat itself. After World War I, after having slayed the dragon, we pulled all of our forces out of Europe and went back to tending our own affairs. And the feeling is that same sort of error might well be made after World War II, because there was enormous political pressure in the United States to kind of revert to a kind of a peacetime economy. You had this whole generation of Americans, they had struggled for all these long years of the Great Depression in the 1930s, and then enormous effort during the Second World War. And the time had come to sit back and relax a little bit and enjoy the benefits of the American material culture, and build a house in the suburbs and start a family. It was the beginning of the post-war baby boom, and suburbanization really starts moving ahead, buying cars, buying refrigerators. Soon enough, in the early 1950s, buying televisions, all that sort of thing. There was this huge craving for that in the country at the time, and the political elite felt like you can't both provide these material goods to the country and maintain a strong defense establishment. The craving for material prosperity is going to squeeze out defense, and we have to fight that. And that what that means is we have to kind of play up the Soviet threat, over-dramatize how awful the Soviets were. This terrible expansionist communist country and so on. They don't keep their promises. And all that sort of rhetoric was used for instrumental purposes, not because it was truly believed, but because it was needed in order to get the American people to agree that American power should be thrown into the balance in order to serve as a counterweight to Soviet power in the imperial area. And we know, I mean, this is not, I should say, this is not just speculation. This is what a lot of people in the U.S. government, in the U.S. elite, were saying at the time. That they needed to take this sort of rhetoric. Dean Acheson is Truman's last Secretary of State. He has this very famous phrase about how there was a need to make things clearer than the truth. Can you imagine? Make things clearer than the truth. We can't be honest with our own country because we're dealing with a citizenry that's so totally unsophisticated that if we just presented the issue to them in a straight way, they wouldn't do what they should be doing. We know better. And therefore, we're just going to have to pull the wool over people's eyes and manipulate their emotions and so on by making things clearer than the truth, by over-defining the Soviet threat and so on. Because we saw this story in 1941. It's like we saw it in 1917, if you buy the whole Lenin-Cannon argument. You're dealing with a country whose citizens cannot be made to think in kind of cold, rational, sober, power political terms. They have to have their emotions manipulated. You have to appeal to their ideological preferences. And you remember the very end of that Cannon article when he's basically saying, look, we pay a price for this. We should realize that we pay a price. Maybe it's time that we grow up as a country. That's the attitude. And so the public opinion at home is like the main audience for what's going on and for why they're banging the drums in early 1946, why they're switching their policy in this way. It's because they now sense that they need to mobilize American power. But the Americans aren't the only target. American people are not the only target in this. There's another target as well. And this has to do with the German people. Germans don't even have a state. The Germans are still under military government. And yet the German people begin to play an important political role in 1946. Why is this? Because we're worried about them, and we don't think that a small occupation and army in Germany is going to be able to kind of keep the lid on things indefinitely. We need to make sure that the Germans throw their lot in with the West and contribute to the overall power of the West. Because one of the main things that happens in 1946 is a shift in U.S.-German policy. What specifically happens? Well, at the overt level, what the Americans are saying is, this whole strategy of running Germany together with the Soviets, which supposedly was embodied in the Potsdam Agreement, this is not viable. Therefore, since the Soviets are unwilling to cooperate with us in running Germany as a unit, we have no choice but to organize our part of Germany, the Germany composed of the three Western zones, Western Germany, to organize it and to kind of rebuild the German economy, give the Germans some hope for their future, allow a process to start that will lead eventually to the construction of a West German state, a state tied to the West in all kinds of different ways. Now, this is called, this is very important, this is called the Western strategy for Germany. You know, a lot of people think, you know, when you're looking at what's important in American policy in the post-World War II period, they talk about George Kennan and the strategy of containment, and there's this new biography of Kennan by John Lewis Gaddis. It's got a lot of attention. Kennan is the architect of the containment policy. All that stuff is, it's so off base, you wouldn't believe it. Kennan was not a terribly important figure. The whole idea of containment, namely the Soviets shouldn't be allowed to gobble up all of Europe, in important ways, all that was in place before Kennan came on the scene. Right? That was implicit in the Berne strategy for Western Germany, implicit in U.S. policy with regard to Turkey and Iran in 1946, implicit in the U.S. policy with regard to Japan and so on, in 1945 even. Containment is not novel. It's like after paying this huge blood price and having made this huge effort to kind of destroy the Nazis, we're going to allow the Soviets to take over all of Europe? Of course not. It's second nature. What was important and what was the true departure in policy terms was the adoption in 1946 of what was called the Western strategy for Germany, meaning that Western Germany would, the three Western zones in Germany, would be organized first economically, then politically, and ultimately militarily, under the auspices of the three Western powers, and tied to the Western world in all kinds of different ways, again, economically, politically, militarily, culturally. Okay. And in particular, Western Germany would be integrated into Western Europe, meaning continental Western Europe. The British didn't want to have any part of it. This is the strategy that leads to what we view as European unification, European integration. But the whole idea is you're giving up on the idea that Germany would be a unified state. Instead, Western Germany would be part of Western Europe. It's very nice from the standpoint of the Western powers. Why? Because it solves their two big problems in Europe at one blow. What are the two problems? The German problem and the Russian problem. If Germany is divided with a powerful Russian army right in East Germany, then West Germany is going to be dependent on the Western powers for protection, and therefore is going to, it can't diverge too much from the political line of the Western powers. Right? So you've solved the German problem. And you can ease up on the controls on Germany because Germany is dependent on you simply because of the nature of the system that's come to be. Right? On the other hand, you've also solved the Soviet problem because you're integrating the most important part of Germany, the most industrialized part of Germany, most advanced technologically, into the Western world, and you're creating a strong block of power in Western Europe that would serve as a counterweight to the USSR and prevent the USSR from threatening you. So you've solved both problems. But that's from the standpoint of the Western powers. But what about from the standpoint of the Germans? You're asking these people to give up on their own national unity, to accept a division of their country, right? To accept the fact that 17 million of their compatriots have to live in Eastern Germany under communist rule. Right? And everyone thinks, well, you know, the Germans are this very nationalistic people. How on earth are they going to accept this sort of thing? And the answer to that is by telling them how awful the Soviets were, how the Soviets are the great saboteurs of German national unity, how the Soviets didn't want to run Germany as a unit, how the Soviets want to create a police state, a communist police state in Eastern Germany that's tied under their control and so on, that they really have no choice. So banging the drums serves to kind of pull the Germans into this strategy as well. So you have this movement in 1946 toward what's called the Western strategy for Germany. What are the key episodes here? It was the decision on the part of the American military authorities in Germany, it was sanctioned by Burns in Washington, to call a halt to reparation deliveries from Western Germany to the Soviet Union. Which is a violation of Potsdam, right? But their argument was that, the Soviets aren't living up to their part of the Potsdam Agreement, so why should we? And this is a way of reclaiming our freedom of action and moving ahead with the Western strategy in West Germany. And the big step that's made there is the decision in July of 1946 to create what's called the Bi-Zone, or Bisonia, it's also called, the merging of the British and American zones, the two most important zones in Western Germany, into a single unit, and with the French kind of gravitating toward that Western bloc in a less overt way. Okay? The Soviets see what's going on. The whole idea of a divided Germany, that in itself is not a problem to them. The problem is not that Western Germany is being organized without them. That they can accept because the Western power, they were organizing Eastern Germany without the Western powers. That they can accept. That was in keeping with their basic spheres of influence philosophy. The problem was that Western Germany was being organized against them because of all this rhetoric that was being dished out to the effect that the Soviets were the saboteurs of German national unity. The Soviets were Germany's real enemy. And so the Soviets respond by playing up to the Germans. Molotov gives a speech in the middle of 1946 that was taking what for the time was considered a very pro-German line. We're your friends, not the Western powers. And the Western powers are upset by this and are worried about losing the Germans because no one thinks that the Germans believe deep down in democracy, and the feeling is we have to hold out the prospect of a dramatic improvement, both in their living standards but also in their political situation, to the Germans to get them to side with us, and not to succumb to these blandishments from Moscow. And so Secretary of State Burns, in September of 1946, gives this very famous speech in West Germany, in Stuttgart speech. You know, again, holding out to the Germans the prospect of them getting their political rights back, they're getting control over their own destiny in large measure if they side with the Western powers. The logic of the situation where the two sides are competing for German favor, again, even though the Germans don't even have a state at this point, okay? The two sides competing for German favor is pushing them to kind of take a stronger and stronger line against each other. So the Americans are pushed to taking a stronger anti-Soviet line. The Soviets respond in kind. In these circumstances, you can't work out a four-power agreement for Germany, for creating a unified Germany. So the feeling is, if Germany is unified, if that unified Germany is weak, that'll be a power vacuum. What keeps the other side from moving into that power vacuum? If that Germany is strong, well, you're back to where you were before 1939, with that strong Germany creating all kinds of problems, playing off East against West. Maybe a divided Germany is the best, right? So you have that idea taking shape. And certainly as the Cold War sets in, as the level of rhetoric and abuse kind of escalates, it's impossible to reach an agreement. Burns is fired by Truman in January of 47 and is replaced by General Marshall, one of the big heroes of World War II as Secretary of State. And Marshall really wants to work something out with the Soviets, but the logic of the situation is too strong for him. And so finally, by the end of 1947, at the London Conference, Marshall finally reaches the conclusion, it's hopeless. We can't work out a settlement with the Soviets on the German question. We have no choice but to move ahead and deal with the German question on a West-only basis. We have no choice but to set this process in motion that would lead to the construction of a West German state. Right? From the standpoint of international relations theory, all of this stuff is of real interest because this is a case of the security dilemma in action. Right? Neither side wants a conflict with the other, but each side is led, for purely defensive reasons, to take steps that the other side will view as threatening. You can have conflict even though neither side really wants it. And you also note the enormous importance of domestic political considerations in setting the stage for that sort of process. So that's what leads to the start of the Cold War, but there's still a lot that remains to be said, and in particular, how are the Soviets going to react to what West is doing? That's what we'll be concerned with next time. The great test of strength in the 1948-49 period.